This episode of the Paddock Pass podcast is brought to you by Renthal Street Components. Over 800 street fitments for handlebars, bar mounts, clip-ons, brake pads, chains, and sprockets.
Hello and welcome to the Paddock Pass podcast brought to you by Fly Racing and Renthal Street. Check out flyracing.com for some of the latest helmet technology and plenty of off-road and on-road gear. On today's Paddock Pass podcast, we're looking back at the Dutch round of World SBK, and as usual, Gordon Ritchie's on the pod, but Ivo Schutzbeck isn't able to make it this week, so instead we've drafted in a little bit of a replacement for the star of the show. Matt Oxley is going to join us as well, and Matt, just to come to you first, obviously the Oxlow Bomb podcast, it's going well. We had Peter Bomb at the World SBK round this weekend, and then we get you on the pod this week.
Yeah. No, what a weekend it was. It was just superbike, wasn't it? It was Le Mans, which is superbikes. It was Navarro, BSB, and World Superbike. I mean, I was kind of watching bits of it all, you know, channel hopping back and forth. I'm not allowed often by the wife to watch motorbike racings on my weekend off. She's like, but it was great. I mean, there was all some great racing paddocks, you know.
Yeah. And Gordo, obviously for you, busy weekend over in Assen for us, but a very different weekend. We had just unbelievable weather. I think even for all of us that have gone to Assen for so long in April, this was unique.
Yeah, I mean, we did get hailstones, thankfully just not during any of the races, but we even had hailstones at one time. Yeah, it was the ever-changing nature of it. Which, as I've just finished my report last night for my various magazines, I think it was the making and the breaking of it. We wouldn't have had that crazy result with Spinelli. We wouldn't have had a lot of the people unprepared, and especially in Supersport, they were just concertina races like crazy. People losing seconds a lap, coming back again. So it was. It could have broken the weekend, but because the racing was good, I think it helped the weekend. It made it such a wild thing to try and predict. And that's good every now and again. You know, we know who the major forces are.
Matt, we've only got you for 15 minutes. You're busy this week, obviously getting ready for the Jerez MotoGP, but just for you as a viewer of Superbikes now, what's the perception for you as a fan of the championship or a viewer of the championship, and then also the perception within the MotoGP paddock of World SBK as we have it right now?
I like all motorbike racing. So I like World Superbike. I don't get to watch it super often because, you know, when you got a weekend off from MotoGP, you generally want to go and do something different, you know, otherwise you go mad. But it's always been a great championship, you know, and I mean, there's no doubt that MotoGP is the premier class and World Superbike is the next down, and that's fine. You know, you've got to have, you know, a kind of, things have to be arranged in a certain way, don't they? And admittedly, the racing in World Superbike is better than MotoGP. No doubt about that. I mean, you know, at COTA we had an awesome race, but that was a bit of a curveball, you know, with Vinales kind of getting a bad start and then charging through and all that kind of stuff. But generally, I mean, I was looking at a first corner shot from the Barcelona round of Superbike with about five guys going into the first turn like inches apart. And you just won't get that now in MotoGP because people can't get that close to it because the aero sort of wake is so huge that, you know, you need to kind of keep a little bit because nobody really knows what's going to happen. You know, the aero makes the racing very weird. You know, riders, if you get into a guy's draft in the wrong place, it can buffet you around, throw you around, or your brakes don't work because you've not got the air stop. So there's no doubt about it that at the moment, generally, I think World Superbike is, you know, the racing is closer and more under GP, you know. But that's a weird thing about motorbike racing. You can just never predict. You know, things start getting more boring and then suddenly you're in MotoGP, then suddenly they get exciting again. It's just such a strange sport to predict, which is why it's so cool, because it's just all over the place. I want it to be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the same situation with you in terms of watching MotoGP. It's occasional for me, you know, just because, and I don't have a broadband package that includes it anymore, which was also another reason why I used to be able to watch it. So I'm kind of watching on the catch-up on Tuesday if I'm not having to do something else. The thing that gets me about all the printed stuff and the social media stuff is that MotoGP doesn't seem to be able to make its mind up whether it's great or terrible. Because everybody's, one week they're talking about MotoGP is the greatest thing in the world and everything else. And then the next week, it's everybody's just, the people there, I mean, are just getting laid into it about boring and overheating tyres and why can't they fix this and, you know, processional racing. And then the next week you get Kota, and everybody, you know, I only saw like 20 minutes of Kota, and everybody's just raving about it, you know. And that's the thing I find much more about MotoGP. It seems to be literally almost week by week, the people there change their opinion about it. I mean, the spectacle, the actual, is the championship going the right way? Is the racing good?
Yeah.
I mean, is that what it feels like? Or is it just because you're reacting to what happens in front of you?
You know, I like a good whinge and a good moan, and I probably...
You're in good company then, Matt. You've joined the right people.
I was probably onto the racing's getting boring again, like the 800s were, quicker than most people, because I do tend to kind of try to think about everything from a subjective point of view. You know, as a journalist, you don't want to get too inside. From an objective point of view, you don't want to be too subjective. You know, you want to be looking at it the way the fans are looking at it and thinking, fuck, this is boring. You know, and then I'll go to see last year when I did an interview with Corrado Ceccanelli and, you know, and Carlos Espeleta, and they said, we don't think the racing's boring. We think it's great. And it's like, mate, you're involved. Of course you think it's great. And also... you know, I'm on the inside, kind of. I'm a journalist sat in the media center, and I can watch quite a boring race and still find it very interesting because there's stuff going on. You know, if you know what's going on, you think, oh, that's happening because of that. But that's not what the fans want. They don't, you know, they want a proper, exciting race. They can't, the vast majority, if you're talking about selling a sport to a bigger audience, it needs to be exciting in a very obvious way, not in a highly technical Formula One kind of way. I mean, Formula One's famous because it's famous, isn't it? People love it because it's Formula One. Even if it's boring as shit, people will still watch it, you know? But motorcycling racing doesn't have that luxury. It's got to serve up proper excitement.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. When you get to a certain degree of gravity, things just continue. I think within the two-wheeled world, and obviously below Formula One, and the way, especially the way it's gone after Liberty's taken it over, and it's now multiplied all the money and the interest in it. I think MotoGP has long ago and always had the gravity of focus. But in recent years, obviously, it's been a big difference since they went four-stroke. I mean, we always said as soon as World Superbike wasn't the only four-stroke world championship and MotoGP took it over, that was it. Because all the marketing money, not just the technical money, but the marketing money and the promotion budgets and everything just all had to go to MotoGP. I mean, we reckoned, I remember working there at the time, Matt, and yeah, we all reckoned it was like, everybody we spoke to said they reckoned it would be five times more expensive just for the tech compared to the two strokes. Do you think that's even more now, given Evo and Aero and everything?
I remember, oh God, I mean, yeah, I mean now, I mean, obviously they had tailor-made electronics then, so that was pretty expensive. But I remember speaking to Fausto Grazzini, you know, and he, as an independent team owner. So he, you know, as an independent team owner, you're going to have a better idea of cost than a factory team, because factory teams, it's basically just an open checkbook, isn't it, really? An unlimited spend. Whereas if you're an independent team, you're counting every penny in and counting every penny out. And he reckoned, yeah, five, six times more expense. But that was the cost of going four stroke, which brought a lot more money from the factories, you know. And now, I think Dorna do quite a good job the way they sort of subsidize the independent teams. You know, they give every independent team 2 million euros a year or something like that to kind of buy its equipment wheel on. So, which is pretty good. But yeah, I mean, you will always get that thing between Superbike and MotoGP that, you know, 1 year or 1 week, the racing in MotoGP better. Next year, the next week, the racing in World Superbike. Normal, I think. But at the moment, yeah, I think definitely is better in World Superbike. But MotoGP is my thing, has been for now. I can still enjoy it for all kinds of reasons, even when the racing is, and it's not just about.
It is about the free lunches, though, because I do miss Ducati hospitality from MotoGP from my time.
But that's
there.
Gone. Doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, well, then I've got no reason to go back to MotoGP.
No, exactly. all the kind of fine dining has gone, much to my horror. Yeah, Philip Morris, they used to have this ridiculous, for people listening, ridiculous, like five-star, you know, close to Michelin star kind of hospitality for the media, where the breakfast and the lunches, they didn't do dinner, but the breakfast and lunches would. But, I mean, you know, I miss it, but I don't, you know, it's not what I'm there for. If it's there, I'm happy to take advantage of it, but it's not why I'm there. Yeah.
Well, that's why I get excited when the FIM turn up to World Superbikes and Gordo gets a little text saying, Big Blue's here. And it's the one round a year we get to enjoy that.
Every time. I'm not even in the track half the time and I get a photograph of the FIM truck. See you at lunchtime.
If we can't look forward to great hospitality, one of the things we always look forward to is new riders coming through that push the boundaries. And I think it's lucky that right now we've got Pedro Costa in MotoGP. Obviously in Superbikes, we've got Toprak. And there are two riders that can capture the imagination, capture the attention. And for me, it's interesting that obviously with the Liberty takeover or acquisition of Dorna that you'd imagine in 6 months should all be ratified, it's one of those situations where people are looking for the next Rossi in MotoGP. Whereas if you look at what Liberty have done in Formula One, they've moved away from having it where it's that one driver, whether it's Senna or Schumacher or Hamilton or Alonso, to making it where people are interested in 20 riders and they're diehard fans for Yuki Tsunoda, who's down the field, or the guys at the very back of the field. They all have their loyal fan base. That's the kind of thing that we really need to see for whether it's Superbikes, whether it's MotoGP, but just motorbike racing in general to grow. But when you look at it right now, when you've got Acosta in GP, Toprak in Superbikes, what do you see for those two riders that makes them special?
Obviously, Acosta, I mean, you never somebody wins the Moto3 championship, you think, oh, he's good. And then they kind of come into Moto2 and they struggle a bit and then they win it and they think, okay, yeah, he is good. But you still don't know whether they're going to jump on a MotoGP bike and be good, you know. But Acosta, I mean, it's just, he's a joy to watch, isn't he? You know, I mean, kind of, he just kind of, so fluid on the bike and just seems to make it do things that, you know, we all thought that Brad Binder was the limit of the KTM, that he was the guy pushing that bike as fast as it could go. And then suddenly like, oh, you know, somebody's taken it to another level and Acosta's that guy. And I guess Toprak is that guy in World Superbike, isn't he? You know, everyone thought BMW, that was the level. And now, you know, I'm not an insider in Superbike, so I don't know exactly what's going on. But it looks to me like he's just come in and gone, right, okay, the BMW level, we thought the BMW level is here, and then it's there. And both of them, when you watch them, you're just willing them to kind of do the next guy, aren't you? You know what I mean? They just I can't help but be on their side, you know, which is what you want. You know, you want someone to root for and or several people to root for. I mean, I've never been a kind of 1, 2, 3 rider, you know. I've always just loved good racing, and of course there is riders that I prefer to others, and generally they're the ones that I think I kind of have a sort of thing that, you know, obviously none of them are ever going to ask me to go out to dinner with them or to go on holiday with them, but you kind of think, would I like to go out for dinner with this guy? Do you think, would he be interesting, would he be fun? Yeah. You know, would he be nice to chat with? And you know, Acosta and Toprak are both like that. You know, I've obviously interviewed both of them and really like them both. I mean, Pedro's just got this fantastic kind of low level arrogance, like you should have as a motorbike rider. Whereas Toprak is very much the opposite, in fact. He's just so humble, you know? You know, I love the fact when he does
till he gets on the bike. And then your character changes, he's just the devil and incarnate, isn't he? On the bike.
Fantastic. And I love the fact that, you know, after a race, you know, when most people win a race or whatever, and it's all like, like that, you know, all the team are kind of gritted teeth and number ones and shaking their fists and all that, and Toprak just he just doesn't do any of that stuff. He's just not interested. And I really like that because like everyone does the other stuff, and so it's just really nice. And that's just his kind of his nature and his upbringing to show him.
Obviously, Matt, you know that we all know that MotoGP is that premier class. That's the one that when riders are kids, they're not saying, I want to be the Superbike world champion. They want to be a MotoGP world champion. But when you look at the MotoGP schedule now, 21 rounds, you look at the Superbike schedule, 12 rounds, you'd imagine we could expand back to 14 rounds like we had at different times in the past. 14 rounds is the perfect number, really. You go beyond that and it's a big chore for mechanics, engineers, even riders. They might fly business class to the flyaways, but it's still 7 weeks on the road. And when you look at the Superbike grid now, we've got a lot of ex-Grand Prix riders, ex-Grand Prix engineers, mechanics, people coming into the paddock. But just to look at one rider as an example, Danilo Petrucci, a rider obviously you know well from his time working or riding in MotoGP, 10 years in the GP paddock. And he's a guy that, at the end of the day, he maxed out in MotoGP, achieved everything he could achieve, which is be a Grand Prix winner, super talent. He comes to Superbikes and I think there's always the expectation when riders come in that they're going to come in and just dominate, or they're going to come in and do a little bit like what Bautista did. But I think, you know, it shows the level that we have in World Superbikes now. And that, I think that's one of the things that for us in our paddock, we're always quite interested to see when riders come across, how interested people are in seeing what their progression is, what their transition is, and then what people view as the standing.
Yeah,
of
I mean,
what we, have in the
we all love Danilo. And I mean, he's one of those riders that you just can't help but like. You know, he's just such a super guy. I guess, you know, he's not won a race. He's had podiums. He's not won a race in the World Superbike, has he? And I guess, you know, he was in a factory team and he didn't, he was podiums in MotoGP until he got in the factory team. Then he won a couple of races. And so I think he would have had a better time in World Superbike if he'd been in the factory Ducati team, or, well, especially the factory. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, you know, you obviously get people like Bautista, you know, never won a MotoGP race. Yeah, I think just being in that factory Ducati team.
He falls into the right situation and suddenly you get to see all that talent. Because at the end of the day, 125 world champion, 250 front runner, you know what he can do. But it is all about the situation.
Which is a combination of luck, timing, you know, all those sort of things, you know. I mean, I think Danilo's issue is that he's fucking huge, you know. Excuse my language. We swear on my podcast all the time.
Doesn't help.
You know, he's 80 plus kilos, and you know, that is too heavy. When Marc Marquez is 65, that's an awful lot of weight, you know. And when in MotoGP and to World Superbike to a slightly lesser extent, when the differences in lap times are tiny, well, I mean, in Superbike, the top guys are all doing it. You know, if you're losing a couple of tenths because of your weight, you're screwed, aren't you? Even one tenth, you know, you're screwed over a race. That's 2 seconds, you know, two threes. Two.
Obviously enough, the weight was one of the things that was a big talking point for us, Gordo. And to see what Bautista's been able to do the last three rounds, he's progressively gotten more and more competitive. We saw in Assen again, three podiums, but it's a slightly different story to what we had in previous years as well, where he's got a 6-point advantage now rather than it was 56 after Aston.
Yeah, I mean, the championship in general has tightened up a bit. Obviously, Alvaro was still hanging on to that injury that he got at the end of last year during winter testing and so on. There were lots of rule changes this year, whether everybody picked them up or not, but there's quite a lot of large and small rule changes. And he's got to carry more weight, but the bike's got to carry more weight. So where do they put it? So now they've kind of worked out where they put it. I need to read the rule book properly, because I tried to get all this taped off in the first round, and even when I spoke to the FIM people on site, it was still a bit kind of, well, we're going to do this, and when do you weigh them? We'll weigh them on Thursday. Do you weigh them every day? We can weigh them after any session we want. So I think they've now found the balance of that. But if you're the engineers and you have to be in the same window, surely Alvaro's got to turn up exactly the same weight, with leathers, helmet, back protector, chest protector, every round, or else they're going to have to play around over the weekend, unless I'm missing something in the rules, Steve. So it's quite complicated. You know, if you're Bautista, you want to be presenting it exactly the same way every Thursday and go from there. Because otherwise, you need to start moving weight around the bike. And when Alvaro's so small, 1 kilo front, back, side, top, 3 inches higher, 3 inches lower, will make a difference. And that Ducati, for being the best bike, is quite finicky. And you have to ride it on the edge. It's got more performance, but you have to go, not the ragged edge, but right on the edge all the time. And look at those dramatic photographs we saw in race 2 yesterday, when you've got Toprak and Bautista tail sliding out of that, I can't remember the name of the corner, the one with the dip on the outside.
That
was Bautista in his first year. Yes. Moonweir, that's right. And that was the extreme example of it. But that's how Alvaro was riding in the first year when he turned up, and had half a season where he just blew everybody into the weeds on that bike. But because no one else could ride it like that. Now the bike seems to have been a little bit smoothed out a little bit, and more people can get on it. Look at what the amazing things that Ian Oni's doing after years away. So anybody who's got a good Ducati is capable of being a Bassani last year, etc. So, but you do have to ride it a particular way to get the best out of it. That to me is the biggest thing with the weight. That's what Alvaro's had to get his head round. The team have had to get their tech heads round. But it does now, as you say, seem to be working And I think now probably he'll be competitive everywhere.
Matt, just before we let you go, one of the big things obviously is Ducati winning in both championships. We're able to see a manufacturer putting the resources into both. Obviously for Gigi Dallinia, his time with Aprilia, a lot of his experience comes from the superbike side. And then he went to Ducati, put that resources into both sides of the program. But when you look at what Ducati's able to achieve, splitting their resources across both championships to have the best bike on the grid, when you look at what we see from other manufacturers, whether it's, you know, Honda is the obvious example, struggling in both championships. But for all the talk of BMW potentially going down the Grand Prix route, how much value is there for BMW to go to MotoGP unless they're able to be at the front? Because at the end of the day, for much of their time in World Superbikes, they were a little bit of a very expensive afterthought.
BMW have a kind of pretty amazing record of underachievement in World Superbike, don't they, really? I think I was writing something about it the other day, and I think their top championship position is third with Melandri in 2012, and they've been there since 2009. I know sometimes they have a factory team and sometimes they don't, and I think that's one of their problems. You know, they're just, you know, you can't do that in MotoGP. You've got to come in with a full factory team. Everything is, you know, you've not got one bloke running the team and one bloke running the engineering or whatever. You know, you've got to have the whole thing under one roof, I think, and they will need to super up their game, you know, because they've not done that well in World Superbike. So they're going to have to work even harder if they don't want to make fools of themselves in MotoGP. They really will. And that, to me, will mean buying a hell of a lot of staff from, you know, it'll be a nice payday for MotoGP engineers. They're going to have to go and get team managers. They're going to have to, because it's so MotoGP is so rare groove now, you know, not only with the technology, but also with the format, you know, the way basically, so you have like free practice on Friday afternoon or Friday morning, but that's already kind of pre-qualifying because they know FP2, not FP2 anymore. God, they keep changing the names. Friday afternoon is basically, it's not practice session. It's pre-qualifying. So you've got to be, on Friday morning, you've got to be ready, getting ready for pre-qualifying. So the only session that you can actually try anything different is Saturday morning. But that's 10 minutes before Q1, rather. So if you haven't got into Q2, you still can't really, that's what happened to Brad Binder and Kota. He struggled on Friday, didn't make it into Q2. So in Saturday morning, he tried two different setups. He went out in Q1. He crashed one bike because they didn't have time to get that setup of his second bike back to qualifying mode. So he crashed his best bike in Q1 and then was complete, or was it Q2? I can't remember. It was completely screwed him for the whole weekend. He ended up 17th on the grid. So you know what I mean? So it's not just the engineering. It's that how you got to work your way around that whole... BMW got a huge amount of work to do if they decide to do it. They're going to have to spend a lot of money. And, you know, obviously Dorna are desperate to get them in there, MotoGP. You know, they want kind of, and especially
20
yeah,
years.
No, exactly. For 20 years, aren't they? You know, and with the Liberty thing coming on, you know, that they kind of, they super want to make MotoGP a bit more glamorous, a bit more F1. And getting a name like BMW in there is a huge part of that, isn't it? You know, you've got somebody that is going to come in and spend a lot. If they do go in, they're going to be spending a lot of money, not only on the engineering, but also on the hospitality and all that. That's Gordo.
Yeah, the BMW thing, I think if they go, because we thought if they go to MotoGP, that might be the end of the Superbike thing. But that was an initial knee-jerk thing. However, everything that is in MotoGP is Superbike or Super Sport-based, all of it. And, you know, every national championship, endurance, you name it. And I spoke to a couple of people off the record on the weekend and, you know, and very unofficial. I don't think that would necessarily happen because we're talking about the relative resources required for each and the limitations that Superbike puts on because it has to be a production bike. You can change certain things and you get concessions to change them through the year. You can't change everything. It has to be basically that chassis and that engine and then stuff that you are or are not allowed to change. So staying in Superbike means that they continue their pinnacle of development of the production racing classes, of which they are everywhere, aren't they? Every championship has got competitive BMWs in it. So, you know, that first kind of, oh, here we go, we're going to lose a manufacturer. In the case of BMW, you probably wouldn't. And you think about it, Yamaha compete official both. Honda compete official, both Ducati compete official. It's not an either or, I think, anymore. You know, so that might be good news for, and it might be very good news for Superbike, for BMW, if they learn a lot in MotoGP that they don't know now because they can't, because they're not doing prototype. And then it'll feedback, why is a Ducati a V4? Because it fundamentally in Superbike is based on an old MotoGP bike, isn't it? Not completely, but pretty close.
Just one last point on all that as well, Matt. Obviously, if Toprak were to go to BMW in MotoGP, he faces all those limits. And obviously enough, whenever he had his MotoGP tests, it was with, I think, basically two hands tied behind his back. Yamaha clearly had the test loaded against him, didn't make the changes to the bike he wanted, gave him, I think it was four sets of tires for 2 days. He had no real chance to be able to push hard. He had no spare bike. He had no real opportunity to see what it could do. This was a test to say you had done the test rather than to give him that real chance of a MotoGP bike. You go over a 30, Troy Bayliss obviously did it, but that was at the start of the MotoGP era. To go in at 30 years of age, we've already seen how difficult it is to adapt to a new bike as you get older. Obviously, Toprak's doing it this year, but Marc Marquez on the Ducati, old habits die hard. And Marc's the greatest rider we've ever seen. And we still see now, 3 races into his MotoGP career with Dorna, the winter tests, he still had it where, you know, press the ride height button at the wrong time, or, you know, different things like that where you're having to adapt. And yep, it'd be a real challenge for Toprak to go. And he's a rider that needs to win. That's the only thing that we see from him. So to go over to MotoGP and not be able to instantly win.
Yeah, well, he's not going to be able to instantly win unless BMW do something completely amazing, which I kind of doubt, because, you know, they've never done Grand Prix racing since the 1930s or, you know, properly, not as a factory team. So, you know, they've got a lot to learn. But yeah, I mean, it's not just the bike, it's the tyres as well, you know. But the thing to remember is that there will be new rules. And I really, really hope, and I know what Dorna want to do, you know, they're going to go down an engine. Not sure that's the right. I think there's better ways of reducing speeds than that, reducing performance. But they're going to get rid of quite a lot of the aero. So hopefully they won't be like these crazy aero bikes that they are now, where you've got to ride them in a very unusual, unnatural, strange way. They're not like motorbikes anymore. They, you know, they don't pit, you know, anymore. They're kind of flat. They're kind of, you know, they're just completely different animals. And also, I think they're going to get rid of all the ride height devices. I hope they get rid of the ride height devices and the whole shot just fed up with them. Well, I've never liked them. You know, the amount of failures we have and people going into corners and, you know, in the front first corner and the ride height not engaging, or Bastianini qualified in pole in Portugal, and he engaged his ride height device at the start of the sprint. But then as he came to the grid, it pinged off. So it's just these ridiculous things like that, which really should not be compromised. I mean, they shouldn't have to be worrying about 100 things to do as they come to the grid. I mean, you've got enough to think about when you're coming to the grid, you know. Nevertheless, you know, having to hit this button, do that, do this, do the other. It's just stupid. And everybody just arrives at the first corner at the same time, which kind of is a good thing, but kind of isn't. It's not safe, you know. You only need to go wrong once. You look at, was it last year or the year before? There was a big pile up at Barcelona. You know, and that's when people get properly hurt, when you've got 15 bikes around.
The thing you're saying there about the changes in MotoGP, if they go down engine capacity, if they reduce the aero, if they do lots of other things to, and we know there is a great movement now to make the bikes, general bike racing, slower, because we're starting to outgrow even the more modern tracks in terms of safety. What, as if anything whatsoever, has anybody said to you or has been discussed in MotoGP about the knock-on effects? Because we're already talking about what may happen in Superbike, right down to the fact that we may end up racing Super Sport. I don't think that's going to happen, but if they want to keep that time differential, you know, 3 seconds a lap or whatever it is, they're not that far away. And remember, Pirelli tyres are production things. They're not prototype tyres. So what are they talking about doing to us from MotoGP, because they have to?
But the there is such an easy way to sort the performance problem. You want to get rid of aero and ride heights for different reasons, not to slow the bikes down, but just because we don't want them. To me, the best way to control performance is with tires, you know. You know, that's and it's so easy to do. You know, you put the bikes, you can even keep the same rims and put them on a narrower to keep the same tires and put them on a narrower rim. You've got less contact patch. Bikes will go around the corner slower. So it's so easy to tune it, you know? So you know, they can say to Michelin, we want X amount of grip or whatever, and they can say to Pirelli, we want X amount of grip. Who knows? Pirelli might be doing, might be the MotoGP tire in 20. Could be. We just don't know. I mean, I think Dorna would be silly to do that because literally every championship they run would be Pirelli. So I don't think that's a sensible thing to do, you know, to have everyone.
I think one of the things with Pirelli that's always easy to forget is they are absolutely obsessed with outright lap records. And that's the biggest issue Superbikes has, because if we go to any of the same tracks as MotoGP, they won't be able to say, we're as fast as a MotoGP bike. Look at our pole position time with a qualifying tire that can do five laps. Whereas when you look at Catalunya, is a good example of it, really fast. I think it was a 39 for the pole. But by the end of the race, you're 5 seconds slower than that because the tire life just can't do it. That's the difference between a MotoGP bike and a World Superbike. Performance times for one lap, a Superbike is really impressive. But over a full race duration, it can't live with a MotoGP bike. And I think that's one of the things that, for me, the tires are the way to do it as well, Matt. But Matt, we've taken up enough of your time. I can hear the dinner bell in the background there for you. So we're going to let you go.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Please. Cheers, Matt. Great to see you, mate. Nice to see you. Take care. Bye-bye.
We're going to let Matt leave. And we're actually got a special guest as well, Gordo. Another one. We've got Sean Muir, the team manager for the BMW Motorrad team in World SBK. And Gordo, when you look at what BMW have been able to achieve this year, it's always interesting to see how the perception of them has changed. And obviously for Sean and the team, they've been around since 2016. It's taken them a long time to get to the point where they're at to be able to be as competitive as they
are.
Yeah,
it has. We were all slightly blown away when Sean turned up at first and was talking about winning quite soon and everything else. I think that certainly that side of the operation underestimated quite how much of a jump it is from a national championship to world championship, especially on a bike that, you know, we didn't just buy two Ducatis and go racing, or two good Kawasaki's at that time and go racing. It's been a big slog for them, but they've done incredibly well when they've had the chance. When SMR had Aprilias, they eventually got to get good results, even though it took a while to do it. Obviously, they're wedded to the BMW situation. We know the shortfalls of that. There have been in the past, and there probably will be until they get completely sorted. But what's changed this year, a few background personnel, both inside BMW, obviously the rider change is the biggest thing. Whatever anybody says, the rider is the greatest performance attribute that any package has. Top Rack is the difference. They have, and I think Sean is probably going to say that they've carried on much as they were. But what they've now got is somebody who they can look at and go, how does he do that? Well, then they go and sit down and look at the data and go, oh, right, he can do that. So they might even take the development of the bike in a different way. But Michael Vandermark's already showing improvement, and obviously he was very injured recently, so that doesn't help him. But, yeah, that whole thing's moved forward with a few changes and one big one. And that one big one is Top Rack and his crew chief, who's obviously got his head round the BMW already and translated that into Top Rack. Now, Top Rack still talks about some limits and things that the bike doesn't do very well. So it's not like there's a massive fix. So that might be the worrying thing for his competition, is that he's still not got the thing dialed in, and he's won races already. Three races, isn't he? He's won three races. I mean, just unbelievable.
Yeah, he's won three. Two of them being the feature length races as well, Gordo. So that means that they lose their super concession for all the tests, and they take them three rounds to do it. Let's hear from Sean, though, about what he thinks about how the season's gone so far. Sean Muir joining us on the Paddock Pass podcast. And Sean, obviously, the big news is we're looking at them right now, the trophies from Catalunya, and BMW back to winning races. Obviously, Top Rack with the team has helped push things forward. But what are the other reasons why BMW have made this big step this year?
Honestly speaking, I think we've got to the position where we were very, very close to kind of making that little step, that step forward. We, with Scott moving over the second team to make way for Top Rack, and the decision to keep Mikey, I'm not sure, you know, looking at that decision, looking at the material that we'd had at the end of last year, the performances of Michael were troubled because of his injuries. Scott had kind of lost his way a little bit, and the really only guide we had at that point was what Garrett was doing. And I guess, you know, not all of us were pulling in that same direction being for results. And I think over the winter period, we brought some revisions, but, you know, not groundbreaking changes that that people all anticipate and think that's going to make that big change. And overall, it was simply just consolidating a setup that we knew worked from our experience over the last years, you know, kind of setting that base and Toprak joining the team and then starting off on that base. And what that did was it confirmed to us that we were on the right path. And it also started to deter us from taking what the rider always requests, you know, is a different setup that we know is actually going to be best for a long race condition. And it just stabilised everything. You know, Michael, you know, is coming back off injuries and his fitness is now kind of coming back. Working back with Toprak, which brought a new feeling in the team completely in terms of, you know, just a real quiet balance within the box. And I'm not speaking, you know, derogatory of any other ride we've had in the past. It just seemed to be that things just clicked in a lot of areas where we were struggling a little bit before. Operationally, from my side, on the SMR side, we just made some fine revisions. You know, bringing Phil on board was great because obviously he worked with me back in the Aprilia days anyway, so I had some good with him and Eugene. His character suited what we were looking for. And just, you know, one or two changes within the group, but generally it's the same group I've had for the last couple of years, except we're getting some results. So, you know, I can't put my finger on one thing that's actually made the difference, but it's just everything's just settled down. We've got a good base setting. The bike's improvements, we've managed to eke the performances out of those improvements. And, you know, we started off on the right foot and quality and testing in January, we were in the right area. And from that point, the momentum starts to build.
Well, let's even look further back than that. If you look at December, you went on a tour of Iberia to try and get Toprak some track time.
Yeah.
And I think this was one of those things that showed how much resources BMW were putting into the project. Now, obviously, Sylvain joins the test rider, Bradley Smith as well, a full test team. But just to say, we're going to Spain for 10 days and we're just going to find wherever we can have dry track and get out there. I think it was, what, Portimao, Valencia and Barcelona or something like that, or Jerez that you went to.
It was. Yeah, that was not by design. It was by default we ended up taking that route. We, you know, we'd already pre-booked the Portimao. I look back at it, it was just crazy times because we were literally just chasing blue sky and sunshine. Forget about the temperature was doing. We just wanted dry track. And that was, you know, we booked a private test in Portimao. Forecast wasn't good for Portimao at the time, the days that we booked the circuit. Literally 2 days, very expensive test for just Toprak and Michael. No one else had wanted to join us because everyone else, you know, it's been well publicised, the mission with Toprak and, you know, different view on that myself, which, you know, I didn't agree with, but I don't know the full details, but that's history now. But, you know, we literally rocked up on Saturday at our workshop at the circuit. We were preparing the bikes. There's a track day screaming around the circuit with 70, 80 track day guys on it. You know, I knew Glyn Margrave, who runs the track days there. And, you know, we were sat, me and Toprak were chatting away. And I said to him, look, you know, it looks like we might not get time at all here. And he said, well, put me out with the track day guys. I said, look, we can't do that. And he convinced me we can. And I went to see Glyn. And Toprak rolled down pit lane with his, I don't think he had a bib on, but he was sat with some of the other, with the other paying customers, getting a debrief to go out. And he got, I don't know, 30, 40 laps on that afternoon of the Sunday, first time on the bike. And it must have been a right eye-opener for the punters on the track day. But that's what we had to do. We were literally backs to the wall. And as it happens, we didn't get any track time at Portimao on the Monday or Tuesday that we booked the circuit. We quickly up sticks and went to Jerez. Same thing there, got to Jerez. No dry track time there, really, to meaningful track time. You know, at that point it was, look, do we just pull up and go home? We rang around. We knew there was a track day on at Valencia. Again, we got some exclusive time there. The test team were already there doing some base work with Bradley. And we just said, look, pack the trucks, let's head north. Everyone jumped in the hire cars and away we hammered it up there from Jerez and, you know, burnt the midnight oil, got to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning after setting up and back up again at 7. But it's what we had to do and it's got us to where we are today. But, yeah, it's that's the team grind you don't see. those are the long stretches people don't get to see, but it's what you do.
You mentioned Top Rack's character and the atmosphere in the team. I think one of the things about the testing restrictions in place, a real motivation as well. He wanted, almost like he was scorned and he wanted to prove people wrong, and that's always a powerful motivating tool. But one of the other things that's very motivating is when both sides of the garage are working together. And I thought the best example of this was the Super Bowl session in Catalonia, where we went in and you could hear Top Rack say to Mikey, "You're losing a lot of time by being wide in this corner.
Yeah.
Get it a bit tighter and we'll go faster." And then pole and second row at the grid for Mikey. It was a really good effort, but it showed two guys that want to work.
Yeah, and I've got to say that I've never had that in this from the get-go, even with Wrighty and Tom and then Michael and Scott. We've never had that environment. And, you know, we knew something had to change. It was frustrating. But, you know, those frustrations in the box, they're born out of no results as well. You know, when you're really grinding away and, you know, you're doing your best and your best is only a tenth or whatever, it really, really is soul-searching. You've got to really... You've got to dig deep to another level there, and it affects everybody from the top to the bottom. You know, we all feel that, and clearly the environment gets affected by that. You know, you're trying to search for something, the riders are running off trying to search for something, probably not there when we know what that base is now. But, you know, immediately Top Rack joining, you know, we were in awe, but we were just super impressed with the calmness, but at the same time we're trying to understand that character as well. We know Mikey inside out. We've been with him, we've been sat at his bedside in hospital through the worst times, and we've been, you know, on the podium at Portimao and with the good times, so we understand what Michael's like. But Top Rack, no, he was a complete blank piece of paper to him. We only saw what the public saw, what the paddock saw, and we were just impressed by he's just a straightforward good guy, human being, feelings like everyone else, an ambition like no, and it just seems to mix really well. And I'm sure, you know, Yamaha had that in years before, and Manuel had that when he had him in Puccetti there. So, you know, we're the benefits. We're getting the benefits of that now, and long may it continue.
Just one last question before we finish up. One of the big things right now is obviously to get Top Rack, BMW had to spend big, to make it an appealing prospect for him. Regardless of the actual figures for it. But now the BMW is an attractive bike for people because Top Rack has shown you can win on it. Vandermark fast at the last round, good before the injuries last year as well. When you look at the change in dynamics for BMW now, this must be a really exciting part of the project, because for a long time, this is where you had to convince people to come here. Now there's people that will want to come here.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try and answer that in some orderly fashion. You know, what we're doing here is not very dissimilar to what we've been doing for the last 3 or 4 years. It's just that we're getting those results now. The work that goes in, the hard hours that go in, you know, we're not doing things massively different. The structure's similar. You know, our briefings and debriefs and input is pretty much the same. It's just that we're getting those results. You know, when we look back over time, Mark and I were pretty cute on trying to get the right riders in. The project needed a world champ like Tom at the outset, and we got him, but obviously it was a different part of his career compared to where Top Rack's is. Equally, bringing Michael on board, you know, that was the right move for us then, and it was the right move for him. Injuries blighted Mikey, so we need to see the best from him, and that is coming. You know, we have spoken to other riders that were nearly ready to sign, and I think you probably know who we're talking about, and it was very close to getting that signing, and that would have been another world champion. But the timing's right. Massive risk for Top Rack, for sure. It didn't feel a massive risk for commercially, there or thereabouts, what you'd expect to pay for a world champion. I think it's far away. But overall speaking, I see that this package in this team with this bike, is as good a bike as on for anyone to tip onto, whether it be a GP rider, whether it be the top of the riders in the world superbike, because I genuinely believe that it is just starting to see its best now. It's just taken a rider like Top Rack, a combination of Michael as well, a bit of fine tuning with some setup, a bit of fine tuning with the personnel and the technical, and all of a sudden the ingredients feel right, and it is an attractive package. But I think we've earned that right.
Just one last thing as well, just about that. 10 years ago, you were winning BSB championships. It seems like a long time ago. When you first came here in 2016, you talked about wanting to win championships. Mm. It's been a long journey to get to this point. But with Toprak, that obviously has to be the goal. But for you as a team, how does it feel to be back where the expectation is to be able to try and win consistently?
You know, BSB was a stepping stone, and it's a fact, you know, I've always supported it and everything that Stuart does with that championship. But, you know, we'd done it. We'd run our course. I think we did fantastic. And, you know, we did what was right at that time, and that was the step to this class. Moving on from through the ranks here in World Superbike, the Aprilia years were really good for us. But, you know, we've been here a long time now. We've done the hard miles. I do feel that our experience of understanding the travel, the circuits, what you've got to deal with has come through all of those years of experience. And I just generally feel that overall in this championship, getting a combination, what I feel now, like the starting of the years in 11 and 15 when we're on our championship winning years, I can have a similar feeling with this year now as well. Just everything clicks, you know, when things are right. You don't have dramas. There's an ambience within the team, and there's a spirit and a know-how behind from the factory to think we're on the right path here. And I do believe that moving on with Toprak, we have 2 years of him. I mean, we're only 2 races in, and here we are talking about a world championship. But Toprak's talking about the world, and if anyone knows the world championship, it's the one that sat on the bike, and when he can as well.
Yeah, well, one thing is, it's going to be exciting to see how the season goes. So best luck for the coming rounds.
Great stuff, mate. Thank you,
Gordo. It was great to have Sean Muir on the podcast, and as he said during that, Toprak's obviously a massive factor. BMW's made their big step forward as well, but now Matt's gone from the pod. Let's talk about the actual Assen round in a bit more detail. What we saw from Toprak was really impressive, because obviously in Saturday's race we were able to see that he was able to get himself to the front of the field in those changeable conditions. He overtook Alvaro Bautista just before the red flag came out. Then the Super Pole race, with no real dry track time, he struggled with the tyre. He'd gone out with the qualifying tyre, didn't like it. I think a cold tired on him. So for the longer race in the afternoon, he used the harder tyre, the zero tyre. And this was the tyre that really helped him to win the race. So good adaptation and learning all the way through the weekend from BMW and Toprak.
Yeah, and as you say, they're going to have to do it at races now, because they won't be able to do it at testing quite as much as they did before. And that's a good thing, because we shouldn't be giving people concessions when they're winning races and so on. That's you know, we don't want to get into the territory that can happen in the future, is the only way you're going to start getting the balance rules coming into operation is when people overshoot because they've had too many concessions that have made them too good. They're winning already. It's up to the other BMW riders and crew chiefs and teams and everybody else to get their guys up to that level, because Toprak has shown what I've kind of said for a long time, is that, look, nothing's perfect, but that BMW is actually better than the results are showing. And I still think that's true. There seem to be two or three areas. The engine is still too zippy. And I think BMW maybe need to, like, real BMW, big BMW behind the scene, maybe need to address that. Especially if we're going to have a limitation on the peak horsepower we're all chasing because of fuel flow control next year, and no doubt for a reduction in fuel use. So that's one element. And I think also that it's not necessarily a weak point, but they're going down a direction that they are the people who use that system, their own car-based system. And whether it's software, hardware, probably just software, they don't have anything to compare against. If they were running Marelli system like everybody else, or 99% of the people in the paddock using, they would at least have something to refer against. They would be able to people to buy, so we'll have that guy from over there, and he knows the Marelli system, and he might walk in and go, this, 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 and this. And BMW fundamentally is a car company. You know, the vast majority of the production technology, everything is based on cars, and that's been a downfall before. So maybe the next stage for them is electronics and doing something about the engine, which is probably a bit too extreme in its design.
Gordo, just when you look at it now, 6 points the difference between Toprak and Bautista. Assen, Catalunya, and Phillip Island were three tracks where Bautista was 9 out of 9 last year. And suddenly, instead of this massive 56 point, almost a full round's worth of points advantage, he's 6 points clear of Toprak. And then we'll go to Misano, Ducati and Bautista. Obviously, you're going to be very confident there. But then Donington, Most, Portimao, if we go to Hungary, Magny-Cours, these are circuits that are going to suit Toprak. And he's certainly going to think that as we get into the summer, it's going to be Toprak time.
Yeah, at the Ryder debrief yesterday, Bautista, for the first time, started talking about the championship and who might be the main competitors in the championship this year. And he did say him and Toprak, and maybe one or two others, if somebody can find a seam of consistent form. But to me, it looks like it's going to be them. Johnny's obviously so far behind already. It's going to be very difficult, even if he really sorts out the setup of the bike in every race from now on. Bulliger has shown a bit of weakness. I think it's almost more interesting looking at how Bulliger performed in these races than that, because he came in really fast. He did a lot of tests, but he wasn't the same force as he was in the first two rounds, whereas Bautista seems to be moving forward. So there's got to be some significant in that, because you would expect Bulliger to be there, completely be there all the time in every race, given how well he's shown so far. So yeah, I think we're going to see Bautista versus Toprak for the championship. And I think it's going to be more to do if Toprak's bike and tyre choices and tyre life can keep up with Bautista. Because at the end of the day, Bautista's been over the world champion the last 2 years, had something different to deal with, as we touched on earlier and everything else. But yeah, he looks like he's beginning to look more like his old self. Yeah, it wasn't a great winter for him, but you know, the bike's something he knows. And I don't think at 5 kilos, they now know where to put it. They now know where to put it to make the least.
Yeah, and when you look at it, Gordo, just before we move on to a couple of the feel-good stories from the weekend, Bulliger this weekend, obviously in the wet race, he was using slick tyres, but the wrong setting on the bike. So this was the toughest weekend we've seen from him so far. An 11th, a second in the Super Pole race, and then back to 8th in race 2. This was a tough weekend for him, obviously 3rd in the World Championship, 16 points down. But you can imagine now that Bautista and Toprak over the course of the season are going to have that consistency, whereas Bulliger might be a little bit more up and down, particularly whenever we get to some of the trickier circuits for Ducati.
Yeah, and I mean, if you just look at the championship table now, there's those three. Alex had an unfortunate crash in the final race. He's done incredibly well at the start of the season. Then you go a big chunk of points, like 29 points from Lowe's to Locatelli on 64. So even Locatelli, who we thought would be Mr. Consistent and so on, has had a kind of slightly rough last couple of, well, all the rounds. He's had one bad result in all the rounds, which has kept him down there. Ian Oni, same thing, a couple of no scores. You know, Vandermark's coming, but when you look at all the riders behind, however good they are, it's not now looking like there's going to be anybody else fighting for a championship. Ridiculous thing to say 3 rounds in. However, in World Superbike, that is a quarter of the season.
It's still 9 races. There's enough of a sample size there to be able to say what we're going to get. So, Gordo, we'll move on to some of the good, the feel-good stories of the weekend. And where do you want to start? Do you want to start with the Super Bowl session or do you want to start with race one? I think we've got to start with race one.
I think race one, because it was just another one of those magic, crazy, wild days where you think, oh, there's not enough laps left. Oh, right. Oh, suddenly there are enough laps left. Oh, the track's conditions change yet again. Oh, look, the people can overtake now because the racing line's getting wider, getting narrower. Just one of those things. And it was one of those, oh, what a story that would have been. And then purely and only because of a bit of bad luck for Locatelli and his engine going and the red flag being thrown, which we didn't know in about at the time. It was, well, why has that happened? Why is a red flag? What's happening? And we just got over 2/3 distance, hadn't we? We literally just done it. And then there's a red flag, so all the people, the conspiracy theorists were out within seconds. Oh, they've done it to me, good result. And, you know, and obviously that's not true.
The two-thirds distance, just so everyone knows, 2/3 race distance is done on your lap counter. So at the start of that lap, you'd already moved into that final third of the race. So from that point onwards, full points are awarded. Don't restart the race. And the second that the red flag came out, you knew Spinelli had won. And Barney knew that they had won, and you saw the celebrations down there. Oh. I think for everyone in the paddock to see Barney win a race, it was cool when it happened in the Super Sport class with Yari Montella, and to see Marco up there on the podium celebrating for the team. But the Superbike class is something different. Then you've got Spinelli. He'd never sat in a Superbike until rolling down pit lane on Friday morning. He's in there in place of Danilo Petrucci. Petrucci had an absolutely horrendous motocross crash. It seems that the grip came off, the rubber grip came off the handlebar, but it stuck the throttle open and he hit a jump and then the bike just accelerated over it and he was just miles into the air and he ended up coming down really heavily. From what Petrucci says, he's lucky to be able to survive the crash, never mind to only have some collarbones and jaw fractures, like obviously serious injuries, but could have been an awful lot worse. So all of these factors go into it, Gordo, and you've got Spinelli, a rider that could have been walking down the paddock and people wouldn't even know who he is on the way to the grid on Saturday, and then suddenly has to go in and talk to the media on Saturday as a race winner on his debut.
So you've got the kind of perfect storm, pardon the pun, given the weather at Assen in the weekend, but the perfect storm of he made a choice of Inter's front and rear. I don't think anybody else did that. Locatelli.
Well, he said the team made this decision and he just went with whatever the team said. Yeah, I'm going with
exactly, because he's a new boy, but it was exactly the right decision. Then it wasn't, and then because of the red flag, it was again. So it's that up-down seesaw fortunes thing. But he wasn't scared, was he? And he's got form, because remember, he was on the Super Bowl podium in Australia 2 years ago? Maybe the November race?
Last year.
The one that also John McPhee was on the podium as well, because of weather conditions. So it's that kind of tyre choice, rider confidence, etc. A lot of things get taken out of the equation. And a rider who's got less to lose usually risks more. But I mean, he was 24 seconds ahead for two laps in succession before the weather conditions changed. And instantly, all of a sudden, the guys behind him were 3 seconds a lap faster. And he was on Inters, not even wet tyres. So, yeah, it was one of those tense races, and you maybe needed to know a little bit about racing to fully understand or try and understand what was going on. But it was thrilling all the same. And then that fairy tale result. And Barney have, you know, they've been on the podium a lot a few years ago on the V-Twin. Then they went through a difficult period. You know, it's been a hard time, but they've been one of those faithful Italian teams that just, you know, they're going to turn up. They're going to turn up well-equipped, you know. And they've got their World Superbike win. They're important for everybody. And we're going to Misano next. What is their hospitality and pass allocation going to look like, Steve? It'll be like blocks of banknotes, how many tickets they're going to have to get for people, isn't it? Crazy.
Just when you're looking at though, Gordo, right, the intermediates were the right choice for Barney and Spinelli, but they weren't the right choice for anyone else. That's why the rest of the fields went out in slick tyres. But what I found really interesting was, do you remember Scott Redding did something similar at Aragon back in 2021 on the Ducati? He was the only rider that went out on the intermediate tyre, and he opened up enough of a gap where he couldn't be caught. I think everyone else might have been out on, you know, a wet front and, you know, slick rear and slicks and all this kind of thing. But he went out in the inters and could make it work. I was surprised no one else went out with the inters. I know Lacco was out in an inter front. That seems to have been a little bit of, there was a bit more went into that than just, this is the decision we're making. But I thought someone would have done it. And the reason I think that is, with Scott Redding, we didn't see this massive drop-off or massive difference between a dry time and the intermediate time. It was about 3 seconds a lap or something like that. If one of the other riders, whether it was Redding or Philip Bertle or whoever else you want to look at, if they had been on the intermediate tyre, they would have been more than 25 seconds up the road. They would have been a lot further forward than Spinelli, because their relative speed would have still kept them further in front. And then as the tyre started to come, or the track started to come more to the slick tyres, they would have been faster than Spinelli as well, because as it stands right now, you can't imagine that a guy that jumped on a superbike for the first time on Friday and had done a dozen dry laps is going to be as fast as someone like Scott Redding if he had been on the intermediate tyres on that drying track. So this was the right choice for Spinelli. It gave him a much better result, even if we had gone the full distance and he finished 10th, a much better result than he ever would have been able to do in normal circumstances. But one of the other riders might have been able to be more in front and stay in front, which I think would have been really interesting if someone had tried something of the same gamble.
Inters, Pirelli always used to try and persuade people to use Inters when they knew it was the right thing to do, and no one would go near them. Absolutely no one. Because it was like, oh, well, if it dries out, it'll break up. Well, the whole point of an Inter is, if it dries out, it's like having a cut road tyre on. If it stays wet, it's like having not a rain tyre. Rain tyre will give you far more pace, but it's heavily grooved. Therefore, it disperses the water. Therefore, you can maintain on a damp track, a wet track, and it won't break up and fly apart unless you use it all race on a dry track. So I'm amazed that people don't want to gamble on intermediates more. It wouldn't have been the right choice if he went 21 laps, no matter what happened. And as you say, maybe if Toprak had done it, he'd have been so far ahead, he would have been able to stay there. That's what you never know. And I think what people do in racing generally is they'll all try and make the same choice so that it's the same for everybody. The top competitors anyway, they look at each other and go, right, I don't want to lose 25 points to this guy just by, you know, even if he beats me, I'm losing 5 or 6 or 10 points, not 25 if I make a completely wrong tyre choice. So I think that's the sheep thing. You know, some sheep, these guys, but, you know, I think it is a sheep thing of, well, just stick together, do the same thing, and then we can't get to
it. Yeah, I think it's one of those situations, if a Tito Rabat or someone had done it, I would have been really interested to see what would have happened in that set of circumstances. Let's look at another feel-good story from the weekend, Gordo. Jonathan Rea able to get back to a bit of form this weekend. We didn't see it really in the results table for the races, but we saw in the Super Pole session, on free practice sessions as well, it was top 5 all the way through, takes the pole position, wet conditions. I said the whole way through the weekend on the broadcast that Johnny's problem is to put it all on the line for that one fast lap. A wet Super Pole session means that you're just building up all the way, so you're able to get faster and faster and build that confidence. And this is where we saw that, you know, Johnny's still Johnny, and he's able to take that pole position and give himself that bit of a lift and a bit of encouragement with the Yamaha.
And I think the most significant thing about Johnny and his confidence, the prospect of stronger performances for the rest of the year on the Yamaha, even in those wet conditions, was I think Johnny's name was at the top of the Super Pole fastest lap thing 5 individual times, and the 5th one, so he didn't have to, he went and did one fast lap faster than everybody else, and then another, you know, that to me is a significant thing. He wasn't set to go, like, okay, well, I don't want to risk anymore. No, Johnny of old, I'm going out again, I'm going to set a faster lap. When Johnny first started, even when he was serially winning on the early years of Kawasaki, he hardly scored any pole positions compared to how many races he'd done. Nothing. You know, absolutely didn't care. Like Wayne Rainey style. Wayne Rainey hardly ever was the fastest rider in practice, but he used practice to be the fastest rider in the race. And Johnny was like that. Then, once he got the confidence from all those wins, he started concentrating on that one-lap pace as well and finding a one-lap setup and a race setup, or combining the two into being fast, whatever tyre he had on it. And that is the first sign. Can you imagine how relieved all those Yamaha people were, every one of them? Can you imagine the relief? You know, Paul Denning, I have known for a very, very long time, before he had a race team even. And Paul and, where were we? Portimao Test, just, you know, and Catalunya just was, he could just, he's all confident and image and so on, but the guy just looked, you know, he was sad. I mean, literally sad. And can you imagine what that's done for him? Johnny, as soon as I asked, I said, well, when he came to the media debrief yesterday, I said, okay, let's get Super Bowl out of the way. Because obviously we do the debriefs at the end of the day when I've then had the first race. And I said, let's get, so he's a bit, you know, normal expression. And as soon as I mentioned the word Super Bowl, he just sprang, his face just sprang into life. He's like, yeah. And he was so keen to praise the team and say, that's great for everybody. It's not just for me, it's for the whole team. And that's what needs to be happening now. They've had a hard time and they're all new to each other. There's a lot of new people or new partnerships made. They have to now coalesce around Johnny and help him to progress on. Everybody maybe has already been asking questions of each other and thinking, well, I know what's wrong here with me, or I don't understand. Maybe it's them. There's plenty of potential for fissures and cracking. And that one thing will have brought all that back together again. They all know now, no, we can do this. We could do this.
Just as well, Gordon, just to look at the other side of that coin, Johnny obviously left Kawasaki. Let's just talk very quickly about Alex Lowe's performance this weekend as well, because for Kawasaki, this was another weekend. Obviously, Lowe's has the crash in race 2 that he takes Jonathan out as well. And it's one of those ones that can happen. I think as the rain started to fall for both Johnny and Alex, they started to come a little bit closer to the leading group. And you just start pushing on, because there's the chance to get back to them. But when you look at Kawasaki, when you look at what they've been able to do this weekend, this was another weekend where they proved the progress they've made. Podium in the Super Pole race, for instance, for Lowe's, and then obviously the crash. But this is 9 races in, first mistake we've seen from Lowe's. But Kawasaki, with the new regulation package, it was really important to come to Aston this weekend and show that bike is more competitive, because Catalunya was always going to be a tough one for them with the limitations they have with their package.
Yeah, I mean, let's deal with Alex's crash first. Turn one, he said, was the only place he thought he could get past. He felt that Johnny was coming to him and that Alex would have more speed at the end. So he wanted to get past him, and he said turn one was the only place to do it, and he made a mistake and crashed. He put his hand up and said it's my mistake. It's a bit Shakespearean that it was happening to Johnny, you know, because they're, you know, former teammates last year, etc. However, the Kawasaki is, you can't say it's transformed because it's the same bike, but the Kawasaki is now the bike it wanted to be, or Kawasaki wanted it to be 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when they wanted to bring a new bike, and you know, at last minute they hadn't changed enough things in it. All through last year, they got concessions as the year went on, but they told us, we can't use them. We need all these things to basically get back, it seems to get back to that engine they had during the winter testing 3 years ago. So when they finally got the last concession in the last year, they were able to do that. And the overall championship rules to allow anybody to, any of the teams, any of the manufacturers to put either a 20% heavier crank or a 20% lighter crank. I'll bet you my last can of Coca-Cola sitting in front of me here that, or Iron Brew actually would be better, but...
You'll bet your last half drank can other of flat drink. Coca-Cola for me, will you, Gordo?
Yeah, well, but seriously, that, you know, that bike is now the bike it was supposed to be, and that's what's helping Alex make the difference. Alex also changed crew chief to somebody who's obviously a bit more rider-oriented rather than being technical and stuff. We've seen the evidence of that already. Alex maybe just needed that all along. But the bike is better. And we saw that in Australia, being able to stay in the slipstream and compete with the Ducatis at the end of the straight. We saw it maybe to a slightly lesser degree in Catalunya, but still there. They've got more revs at the top, but they're also able to use the advantages they had when their bike was even more powerful in the days before everything was clamped down on. And that's when that bike worked best, with a very light crank and high revs. And it's an old-fashioned engine design, very small bore, very long stroke. So they need to make it rev a bit to get the same power as the rest of them. So everything's come together really well. I think we were all surprised that Alex did that. But to get a podium in Assen, and the company that everybody was in, even with weird weather and everything else, is another shot in the arm. The crash is just a bit of bad luck. I think it could happen to anyone.
We're running into overtime now, so apologies. I know that everyone likes a pod that lasts about an hour, but this one's going to run that little bit longer because of the Sean Muir interview. But Remy Gardner on the podium as well. First podium for Remy. It's been well-deserved. He's riding really well this year. But Gordo, the next feel-good story, Glenn Van Stralen, able to win in the Supersport class at home. I actually texted Curve. We're recording this on Monday. I texted Curve and Boss this morning, the team manager, and I said, I'd imagine you're feeling just awful this morning. And he texted back and said, absolutely horrendous, mate, because they would have celebrated that one, because a home win, we haven't seen a Dutch rider win in the Supersport class since Vandermark for Tenkate back in 2014 when he won the championship. But for Glenn, you trade the podiums he's had in the past for this home win.
Yeah, and I mean, he did come close in the past. He's podiumed at Assen before, I'm sure, and he's also had bad luck at Assen before. A lot of pressure on him being a Dutch rider in Tenkata. You know, that's not a normal situation. They don't just choose Dutch riders, even as their perceived second rider. So you can imagine the pressure the guy was under. Imagine the weird conditions that were happening. And Glenn's always, you know, I mean, Glenn's a... I'd interviewed him at some length last year, I think. And he said, it's very difficult to be a Dutch rider nowadays. You know, so now he's in Tenkata. Okay, the Ducati is probably the best bike in that class now, but the Yamaha still seems to be competitive when the conditions are right. And look at what he did, you know, and following on from Saturday, from qualifying, you know, I mean, he qualified really well. So he handled all that pressure, really tricky conditions, special paint job, in front of the Dutch crowd. And I have to say, I was actually Peter Baum, Matt's colleague in their own podcast, was there being a Dutchman. He was there at the weekend, working and also just being part in the media centre. And I said to him, look at all those people out there, all those Dutch people have been rained on, hailed on, freezing cold, sitting there, you know, all day for 3 days. And it's been, they were great entertainment. The race has been fantastic. But look at what happened when they, you know, that last race of the whole weekend. That's worth it. If they paid whatever they paid for the entry fee, that made it worth it. And all the cold and horror. It was like a literally a fairy tale ending. Because, and for Glenn as well, because he was one of those guys that might never quite have won a race. Because there's always such competition. Remember, everybody went mad when Rafael De Rosa won a race finally. Everybody, even his rivals, were happy. Well, Glenn's got one big monkey off his back, and the pressure on he was under to do it must have. So, yeah, we ended the whole weekend, other than the weather, was a great feel good factor. So many good things, but that was absolutely, absolutely the orange icing on it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously, enough, Gordo, the good thing for Superbikes is it is pretty cheap to go to as well. I think for Donington, for my group that usually goes over, I think it's 50 quid for the weekend or 60 quid for the weekend, and you get access into the paddock. So it is one of those things that when you look at everyone coming down Victory Lane, as it's called, coming in towards Parc Fermé, you get right up against it, and it makes it that little bit more special as well. And Gordo, just go ahead.
No, I mean, I think that's the thing that people maybe don't understand about Superbike if they've never been to one. It's like the same access you get more or less at a kind of national level meeting or a club, even a club level meeting. Not completely, but I mean, you know, you can't walk in and out their garages, but you can walk along the front of them. You know, you can, you're really immersed in the weekend if you choose to. You can watch the races from the banking and get inside in between and go and talk to people, get autographs signed. You know, all the races have a podium ceremony inside the fans. It's an amazing, immersive weekend. You don't have to just sit on those bankings and that's you all day. And some people say, oh, there's not enough races at Superbike rounds and so on. Okay, but it's a world championship. You can't have 17 classes like you do in domestic championships.
I have to say, Gordo, as the man has to commentate in all the races, we have plenty of races.
And we haven't even got a women's world championship yet.
Women's world championship starts up at the next round. Yeah. And that's another two races a weekend for me to have to commentate on as well. So this weekend we had the Northern Talent Cup. I'm commentating on that. And it was one of those weekends where there was just more and more. But what I will say is the last main race of the weekend, the Supersport 300. When you look at it as well, Gordon, the Supersport 300 race, we were able to see another feel-good story, a double race win for the Team 109 boys with Danny
able to win. Squeeze the Irish guys in.
I'll squeeze the Irish team in. Just because it was another one of those moments where, like anything else, Gordon, whenever you're in the paddock, you do gravitate towards certain teams, whether they're because of where they're from or there's one person in it that you know, whatever it is. I'm down with the 109 guys quite a bit over the course of a normal race week. I might only see them for 5 minutes, but it's just to check in with them whenever you're down, just seeing what's happening in 300 paddock. But to win your first race is something special. To back it up with another one is really good. And this team's been through the mill. It was set up after a rider died, an Irish championship rider died, and they set the team up in his honour. And I think that was, you know, the best part of 15 years ago when Sean Hurley died. And the team has been building ever since then. And then this is the culmination of it. But, you know, this is why we go racing.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, to win two in a weekend is unreal. Iraki did it last year. I think Svoboda maybe did it in Assen last year as well.
Svoboda as well. Jeffrey Bowes won his first race and then followed it up as well. I think it's happened a few times in 300s.
And you know, it does. That's always, you know, the first one wasn't a fluke if you win both of them, especially in that class where you could be a winner and then 10th and a second away from a win. So, yeah, no, it was another great story. Anybody can win in that championship. Anybody. Races, I mean. You know, there will be the same top few guys competing in that championship. But, yeah, for a new team to do it their first time as well is kind of remarkable that they did it twice. It's impressive they did it once. It's remarkable they did. And 300 is, there's a lots of things we could talk about 300s all day. We're not going to, but it does deliver unbelievable racing and competition. But when somebody wins both races in a weekend, that's the class of the weekend, because to win one is almost impossible. Never mind to win two.
As well as that, Gordon, we had the Dutch rider on the podium, Lars Veneman, as well. So another class where the Dutch were able to have something to smile about. And our goal is always to give our Patreon supporters something to smile about as well. That's where we had the Sean Muir interview was posted there. We have lots of content through the course of the year. We have the Gordon Ritchie Remembers series, obviously, for Superbikes. And Gordon, we're going to be getting back to recording some of them fairly soon. But they're a lot of fun to do, aren't they? I like to be able to see what it was like for you when you were, I was going to say fresh face, but at least a little bit more colour in the stubble, let's say, Gordo.
Well, I might be brave enough to tell you some stories about the post-race parties, because I ran into Garrett Tincate in their, one of their launches that they always do at the round, and we were chatting about the old times and everything. And we were both bemoaning the fact that, you know, it's so sanitised now. There's no parties on Saturday night. You know, there was always either a party in Alstarry or Tincate or somewhere else. And that was it. You know, if I left the media centre at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, there would be people still partying on. And that's not even, they're not even doing that at 8 o'clock at night anymore, you know. And it's a big shame. I know the sport's more professional, but once you've done the job, there's no reason why everybody can't cut loose on Sunday night. But everybody's just getting home. They're flying home on Sunday nights. They're not hanging about. They're not doing the social. That is something that's missing. I think that would be a good thing to get back to in World Superbike if we're talking about redrawing World Superbike for a future, is to make it more of a festival. That has to happen. We have to be the opposite of MotoGP, more accessible, more fun, you know, not as serious. That's always been part of the attraction of Superbike. And in Assen, the fans are just so enthusiastic that even the weather can't spoil it. All I remember about Assen is this being a great weekend, even though I was freezing. And the house we rented for the weekend and at the track, you know.
So. It's one of those ones where I was one of those people just busting myself to get on a flight last night. And I got to the airport and I went up to the check-in desk and I said, I'm due to fly tomorrow. Any chance that I can fly home tonight? And luckily enough, they said, yeah, work away.
Wow,
and
really?
Be tucked up in my bed by 11 o'clock last night. That was a nice touch for me. But Gordo, we've got 7 weeks off now before Misano. So we're going to be back for another Superbike pod in the meantime. We'll have Evo on for that one, obviously. Evo's just had the public news, his new role as the editor-in-chief of Speed Week. So it's a busy stretch for Evo. So it was nice to get Matt on the pod here this week to be able to join us for it. But Gordo, I've got the Northwest 200 and the TT coming up. What's on your calendar?
I may or may not go to some tests in Italy. That's a possibility. I have got 2 million things to do at home as usual. And it's my wife's birthday tomorrow, so I've got a wee surprise for her to take her out for the day. I'm going to meet up with, I'm doing a run with Ian McPherson and the old bikers, the old Scottish bikers, and maybe a couple of boys from down south as well, coming up for a bit of it. It's a twin-pronged attack. Simo's leading a bunch from the south, and McPherson's leading a bunch over the top and down from the north. So that's cool. And I'm meeting all my old pals that I grew up with. We do an annual get-together as well, and we're doing that out east, out in Howard Selby's place. So he has been warned. I won't tell him what date we're turning up, but I'll definitely be coming to see. So he should be afraid, be very afraid, Howard.
Not so bad, Gordon. That's a good way to spend the gap between now and Misano. And obviously here on the Paddock Pass podcast, we're going to be busy because we're now back into the thick of the MotoGP season as well. So David, Adam, and Neil are going to be on site at the Spanish Grand Prix this week. So check out patreon.com/paddockpasspodcast for our Paddock Note Show, our daily roundup show all the way through that weekend. So check that out on Patreon. And as ever, just make sure to check out on your normal podcast platforms for any new episode of the Paddock Pass podcast. Big thank you to Gordon Ritchie for being on the pod today, and to Matt Oxley as well. And then a big thank you to Renthall Street and Fly Racing for supporting the Paddock Pass podcast.